You've been searching for the best way to generate passive income in your life and heard that real estate is a great way to do it. But you're tired of all the so-called gurus who are all talk and no substance. Get ready to celebrate because Kevin Buck has spent 14 years successfully making it happen. This is the Real Estate Investing for Cash Flow podcast. Now, here's Kevin Buck.
Hey guys, Kevin Bupp here, episode number 112 of the Real Estate Investing for Cash Flow podcast. Our mission is to help you build and maintain massive amounts of cash flow through income-producing real estate investments. Our guest for this week's show is commercial real estate and parking lot expert John Roy. And in today's discussion with John, we're going to talk about the little-known niche of parking lot investing. John is one of the foremost experts in the industry and spends time both on the investment side by personally owning parking lots, as well as running a full-service brokerage firm that solely specializes on parking lot sales. And my time with John was very enlightening, as I knew literally nothing about the parking lot business prior to our call together. And if you're like me, then you're always open to learning about new investment methods that can provide you diversification and long-term cash flow and wealth creation, because at the end of the day, it really is all about cash flow and wealth creation, right? Well, you're in luck because that's exactly what we're going to be talking about in today's show with John. And in this show with John, you're going to learn the following. You're going to learn how John got his start in the parking lot business and how purchasing a few dilapidated homes near Notre Dame football stadium has spawned into a full-blown multi-million dollar business for him. You're going to learn what the air rights of a property are and why these can typically be much more valuable than keeping the parking lot as an income-producing property. You're going to learn the step-by-step process of getting into the parking lot business and purchasing your first parking lot investment. You'll learn why parking lots make for low-maintenance investments in comparison to other commercial investments like apartment buildings, office buildings, mobile home parks, shopping centers, and such. You can learn what the value-add components are that you need to be looking for when seeking out a parking lot investment. You learn how to properly underwrite a parking lot investment when there are little to no financials available, which is quite a common scenario when dealing with small-scale parking lot and mom-and-pop operators. You can learn how automation is changing the parking lot industry and how these changes are having a positive impact on the industry as a whole. You can learn what type of financing is available in parking lots and how to obtain bank financing even when you're buying a parking lot that doesn't have accurate financial statements available. You can learn how to utilize out-of-the-box strategies to find opportunities, even in today's competitive environment, and much, much more. And if this is the first time you're tuning into our show, I want to welcome you to our incredible family. And for all the mothers that are out there, I want to say happy Mother's Day to you. I know that it was yesterday, but it's one day later. So just congratulations and happy Mother's Day to all the mothers that are out there. I hope you spent time with your families and had just a beautiful day. So I wanted to take a few minutes, like we always do in each episode, to give a shout out to our listeners that have taken the time to go over to iTunes and leave a 5-star rating and review. And I've got two here today. The first one is from screen name Jeb Brilliant. And he says, I look forward to each and every podcast. I learn from all of them and really appreciate the time Kevin gives to listeners. It's not really easy producing a podcast, but they keep magically appearing on my phone. If there's one podcast to start listening to, then it's this one. By the way, my favorite episode was number 12, all about passive income from self-storage units. Thanks, Kevin. And the second one we have here is from screen name MWIN09. And they say, I listen to a lot of podcasts, and this is definitely one of the most informative and immediately applicable podcasts for multifamily real estate investors. Thank you, Kevin, for what you do, as this show truly adds value to my real estate investing career. Well, thank you to both of you guys. I really appreciate you taking the time to leave those reviews. I mean, it makes my day, and I love reading them each and every time that that one pops up there. And if you listen to the show and you feel like we add a ton of value to in your business, and you haven't left a review yet, then I ask you a favor. If you don't mind going over to iTunes, leave a review for me, make it an honest review, make it an honest rating, and I'll give you a shout out in a future episode. It really helps us attract great guests to the show, provide you an incredible amount of value. So hop on over there to iTunes and leave that review when you have a few extra minutes. And a few laundry list items here I want to go through. The first is the 30-minute free phone consultation that I've been offering. You can get on the call with me, and we can talk about anything your heart desires regarding real estate investing. There's no ulterior motives on this call. It's just a way for you and I to connect and talk about real estate investing. So whether you're working on a deal, maybe you're just getting into the business, maybe you're a sophisticated operator and you just want to talk shop, whatever it might be, let's jump on the phone together. I'd love to meet you. I'll take 30 minutes out of my day to do so. And, you know, who knows where it might lead from there. I can tell you that I've met incredible people over the past couple of years. I've been doing this free 30-minute phone consultation and have even done some deals with a few of the listeners that I've met through this 30-minute phone call. So to schedule that call, what you need to do is go to my website, kevinbupp.com. Scroll to the bottom right-hand corner. There's a button that says schedule a call with Kevin. Click on that. It'll take you to my calendar link. And there on the calendar link, you'll actually pick a time and date that works best for you. I take these calls on Fridays. I do know that the calendar is booked out a little bit. I think it's a few months out. So just, you know, if you can't find a time that's, you know, that's in there, I'm sure there's probably about 2 or 3 months out, you know, the most recent time that's available. But if there's, if something that you want to discuss, if it's a pressing issue and it's time sensitive and you can't wait a few months to chat with me, then, shoot me an email directly, kevin@kevinbupp.com, and we'll get in the phone together, okay? But only if it's time-sensitive. Don't take advantage of that, please. I'm a pretty busy guy, and but if it is a time-sensitive issue, maybe you're working on a deal and you're in due diligence, you know, maybe your period runs up before, you know, my calendar has availability. So if it's something like that, something time-sensitive, I'd be more than happy to make time for you, kevin@kevinbupp.com. Shoot me an email, and we'll hook up, okay? And just a few more things before we get rolling here. As I mentioned last week, if you tuned into the show, I just I gave a little apology about our Mobile Home Park Academy and the Mobile Home Park podcast that we've been working on. We just had a bunch of delays. I really had hoped that it would be launched at the beginning of the year, and that just hasn't been the case. And lots of different things. You know, we've had delays due to deals we're working on. I mean, we are an investment business. We don't just sell education. In fact, that is the complete opposite of what we're going to be doing with this Mobile Home Park Academy. We make our money from investing in real estate. And so that's what we've been busy doing. And so it's caused a little bit of a delay along with some technical issues with the website and things of that nature. But in any event, we're in our final stages. So just appreciate your patience. Bear with us as we work through these final stages of getting this thing launched. And I'm positive that you're going to find that it was well worth the wait. Okay. It's going to be absolutely incredible. So the podcast is coming out soon. The MHP Academy is coming out soon. And if you have an interest in mobile home park investing, then you're definitely going to want to stay tuned, okay? And a few more laundry list items here. I gave a little update last week about the partnership opportunities that I had been mentioning there for a number of months. We do still take on partners, but I can tell you that we're going to be changing our model a little bit here as we release the Mobile Home Park Academy, and that any students that are in the actual Academy program, we're going to reserve any joint venture partnerships that we're looking for those that are actually in the academy. It's only fair that if we're providing the training and we have students that are going through the training and they're learning how to properly buy parks and learn our systems and processes, that we give them the first right of refusal to partner with us on any mobile home park opportunities that me and my team have. And so from this point forward, we will not be taking any outside joint venture type partnerships on deals unless they are either in the academy or have gone through the academy. And so this is not to force your hand to go through the academy. It's just in our best interest as a business to run more efficiently by making sure that any joint venture partner that we bring on board and do a deal with has the proper training and knowledge and understands this business inside and out. And so just want to throw that out there. So if you do have an interest or you've had an interest in potentially partnering on a deal with me or my team, then it's going to be a requirement or prerequisite that you have to go through the academy in order to do that. Okay, again, this is not to force your hand. This is just in everyone's best interest so that you have the proper knowledge and education to be a player on the team, to be able to contribute to the team. Okay. And other than that, guys, that's all I have here for today. So without further ado, I'd like to get onto the show with John Roy. So here we go. All right, guys, today on the show, we're honored to be joined by commercial real estate and parking lot investment expert and co-founder of J&L Parking, John Roy. John is an expert in the U.S. parking industry and has co-written a book on parking acquisitions called The Ultimate Parking Business Buyer's Guide. He's a member and guest speaker for the National Parking Association, where he has taught investors the art and science of parking asset valuation and preparing parking assets for sale. In addition to being a certified parking professional, John holds a bachelor's degree in finance from San Diego State University and an MBA from the University of Notre Dame. So without further ado, let's welcome John Roy to the show. John, how are you doing today?
Doing great. How you doing, Kevin?
Doing fantastic. And just to give our listeners a sense of geography, where are we calling you at today? Where are you based out of?
I'm calling you from my humble horse ranch just west of Fort Worth, Texas.
Okay. Good deal. That sounds exciting. Sounds very peaceful and serene. Well, John, what I'd like to do here in the beginning of the show is I'm going to pass the mic back to Hugh. And if you could, just take a few minutes and maybe fill in some of the gaps. I mean, I gave a really brief introduction for you, but I'm sure your background is a lot more expansive than that. So just tell our listeners a little bit more about yourself and how you got into this very unique industry.
Yes, that's a common question about how somebody gets into the parking industry. And it really was through boredom and through luck. I guess that's how all great beginnings usually start. But I was living in Orange County, in one of the most affluent neighborhoods in probably the state, back in 2004, doing very well for myself and my family, and got bored. So I decided I wanted to do something more exciting. I applied to grad school at USC and at Notre Dame, ended up getting accepted to both, and decided I wanted a little bit of adventure, so I moved my family to beautiful, sunny, warm South Bend, Indiana to go and get my master's degree over there.
Okay.
So when we got there, we sold our house in Orange County. We literally had our life savings, which at the time was $250,000. And I made a promise to my wife, and I promised her that I would not touch the money and that we would use the money to get through the 2 years that would be required to get my degree. And we got down there, and I actually kept my promise for about 2 weeks until I saw the most amazing opportunity that I had ever come across. And it was an old, run-down, dilapidated house that had been condemned. And what people saw was an old, dilapidated, condemned, run-down house. But what I saw was an opportunity. And that opportunity was for parking, for game days, for the University of Notre Dame football. So I bought the house cash and started buying all the neighboring run-down, dilapidated homes right next to the university. And before I knew it, I had blown through our life savings, but I owned a lot of really old houses. So we started tearing them down, and come game day, we started charging people to park on the lots anywhere from $20 to $50, depending on who the opponent was. So we would have fans that would come up from Michigan or USC, and we'd charge them $50. Everybody else, we'd charge them $20. And they ended up paying. And so we learned a valuable lesson, and that is that pricing and parking is very flexible. And what one person's willing to pay, another person may be willing to pay a lot more based on the demand and supply.
Mm-hmm.
So we would end up with a lot of cash on game day, sometimes between $10,000 and $20,000 cash in our pocket, and we'd go and watch the game, and that's how we'd end it, and we'd do it all over again. So we were done with that, graduated, and I decided to sell off the properties, and we sold them off to a developer for student housing. And that's where I learned my second valuable lesson about parking, which is that sometimes parking is worth more as a development than it is as an actual parking asset.
Mm-hmm.
So after that, I came back home to Orange County, worked at a corporate job again, and hated it, and decided I wanted to find another parking opportunity, and found out that there wasn't anybody in the country that could direct us towards buying parking assets.
Hmm.
So we kind of gave up, took whatever money we had left, and decided to start buying other businesses, and we ended up with, unfortunately, a mobile home park in Northern California.
I love mobile home parks. we might get into an argument here. That's my specialty.
And, you know, the asset class is great,
yeah,
but if you don't know what you're doing and you jump into it, it could be a nightmare.
Absolutely.
So we started a mobile home park, and you know that better than anybody. So we bought about a 25-space mobile home park in Northern California. It had a little general store attached to it, and everything that you can imagine going wrong went wrong. We had a slip and fall case within, you know, the first week that we purchased it,
of course.
Boy. We had a workers' comp claim from the store, you know, the leach field being backed up. So we weren't prepared for it. We didn't have the knowledge. It was a great asset class, great model, and we just realized that we had to get out of that and stick to what we knew, which was parking. My partner called me up and said, you know, we're going to start a company. We're going to start brokering for parking assets, and that's really how it all got started.
Interesting. Okay. That's a good story. I like it. I like it. So basically, you guys, you saw something. You saw a vision, that very first property in Indiana there, you know, outside the stadium for Notre Dame. I mean, you saw an opportunity that a lot of others didn't see. What, I mean, I'm sure there was other parking lot investors in that space, right? I mean, whoever owned it, I mean, was it, were most of them mom and pops? I mean, it seems like it's probably a little bit of a fragmented industry to where there's probably some mom and pops. There's also some big institutional guys that own these. Was that kind of the case in that first location where you bought those dilapidated homes and tore them down? Because I would think that someone else might have seen that opportunity first and taken advantage of it. I mean, why do you think that you were the only one that came along and saw that opportunity that existed?
And that's the whole key to the parking industry in general. It's a highly fragmented industry, whether it's South Bend, Indiana, or the national parking scene.
Okay.
There's about approximately 40,000 locations in the U.S., and 65% of those locations are owned by single property owners.
Hmm.
So within that, you have a lot of fragmentation, and you don't have anybody that has really come around to try to consolidate that industry. And I'm sure it's very similar to what you're experiencing in the mobile home park industry. But back then, it was just really people who owned homes, and they were parking people in the front of their yards. And everybody at the time was afraid to take on the university. They had some very heavy ordinances, and they really frowned upon people taking properties and tearing them down and building them into parking lots. But I wasn't afraid to take on the university, unfortunately, and I kind of gave them a headache, and they were very glad to see me graduate.
Interesting. So tell me about that process, what that looked like, getting those rezoned for parking lot use. I mean, how long of a process was it? Was it expensive? Was it really a big battle that you went through to get that done?
Not there, but okay. Throughout the country, it can be a big battle.
Okay.
And parking lots are about as popular as other unfavorable businesses that are sometimes concentrated in downtown markets. But if it was up to most cities, they would do away with parking. They want to see a higher and better use for these surface lots, and sometimes they will put moratoriums to prevent any additional parking from going into their downtown markets.
Interesting. Okay. So I'm just going to take a wild guess, and I'm just going to make some assumptions here and say that probably there's very few, if any, of our listeners that currently own or have ever even considered parking lots as an investment vehicle for themselves. And maybe I'm wrong, but I'm taking a wild guess there. So if you would, what I'd like to do is to start off with some of the basics. And let's just make the assumption again that everyone listening in, we're all savvy investors. We own other types of investments, and we're looking for some diversification into our real estate portfolio, and we heard about parking lots. And so I want you to walk me through, if you would, the good, the bad, the ugly of the business itself and what we really need to know before investing in one. Can we go through it that way?
Sure, absolutely. There's really only two options if you want to invest in parking. One is you have to go and purchase a parking asset yourself, and that usually requires some capital. The parking that is desirable is not cheap. We get calls all the time from people who think they've discovered the greatest asset class, which it is the greatest asset class, but they think that they're the ones that just discovered it, and they'll call up and say, we want invest in parking assets, find us double-digit returns, and they just don't exist. You know, they're very, very low type of returns in the parking industry. The second option is to invest indirectly in parking, and that is through a REIT, for example. And there's only one REIT that we know that purchases parking assets that we actually represent, and then they go and purchase these assets so you can own a fractional share of that. So those are really the only two options. Now, what makes parking a great asset is the fact that there's no tenants, no toilets, no trash. So it's a very low capital intensive type of investment, very passive, where you take a 10 by 18 piece of black copper concrete, you draw two yellow lines along it, and then you charge people to park their vehicle over and over and over again, sometimes a few times a day.
Mm-hmm.
That is a basic premise of parking. It hasn't changed since the beginning of time, and we don't anticipate for it to change in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So once you understand that, you actually have to find the asset. finding the asset can be a challenge, and that's what has allowed our business to thrive. And that is because it's highly fragmented, but also highly competitive. It's an asset class that is highly sought after by large institutional investors.
Okay. So you mentioned that parking lots typically have low reoccurring capital requirements on an ongoing basis, right? I mean, in comparison to an apartment building or an office building, any other type of structure, basically. I mean, it's extremely low. Really, it all depends on the road surface. It could be asphalt, it could be concrete, could just be gravel, whatever it might be. And you got some, parking curbs or whatever they're called, and maybe some meters, but really there's not much upkeep, maybe keeping the weeds sprayed down, things like that. So very, very minimal upkeep. Is there anything else? I mean, what are some of the other general upkeep items? I mean, capital improvements that would need done, or capital expenses you would incur when owning a parking lot that I'm not thinking of?
Well, for a parking lot, they're very minimal. You'll have to resurface the actual surface of the parking lot every few years, restripe. The key, though, is to automate. What's happening out there is that you add most of your value right now through automation, and that's a great opportunity for anybody listening out there. If they're able to find a parking asset, a lot of the times you're going to have the old, what we call honor boxes, which are the little boxes with the little slips, and you have to try to force your dollar in there.
Yep.
Or you'll have a cashier with a booth, and you have to hand them cash. So that is where we find the most amount of opportunity within the industry, and I'll tell you why. And that's because, according to the National Parking Association, you get an average increase of 30% in revenues through automation.
Hmm.
At an average site.
Okay, go ahead. I was going to say, why is that? I mean, is it just, if you had a parking lot attendant, obviously you eliminate the payroll expense there and, any additional costs that come along with that. If you have one of those little slot machines, the slot machines, whatever you called those, why would actually that eliminate, some of your overhead? I mean, what's the cost factor in with that? That someone physically has to come pick it up? Is that why?
There's a study that shows that an average dishonest worker can steal up to $100 per day at your site in cash. But a manager, if they're crooked, can steal up to $1,000 per day.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because they have access to multiple sites. They have keys to the cash. So it is a business that is cash intensive. And by design, a lot of the owners in the fragmented industry do not want to automate. They don't want to have records. They want to keep doing business in cash. So it's untraceable. It's unreportable.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever you find those opportunities where you see an honor box or somebody working out of a booth, you can automatically assume that there's going to be inefficiencies, there's going to be leakage, there's going to be opportunity there for you. You have to remember, the average worker at a parking lot has up to 8 hours a day to figure out how to steal from you.
Right.
You've only got a few minutes every day to try to figure out how they're doing it.
Sounds like car washes. We looked into car wash investments about 8 or 9 years ago. It's kind of a similar industry in that, I mean, very cash driven. You find a lot of these mom and pops that really were, they didn't want to go the automated route because you're right, they wanted to skirt Uncle Sam and keep as much of it off the books as possible. But yet those owners that had multiple locations that had some kind of manager overseeing and picking up the cash for them, I'm assuming there was a ton of leakage within that business model, where there was, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of coins going to that manager's pocket before it ever made it into the bank account. So quite interesting. So how do you guys seek out these types of value add opportunities? I mean, so you can't just go buy a list of all the parking lots in the country that haven't been automated yet. So what's the strategy look like? If you're working with a new client, they're a client that is somewhat savvy. They understand the asset. They understand the model enough. They've got money and they're looking to invest it. They're interested in, I'm sure everyone's interested in buying something that's a value add opportunity, right? I feel like that's like the word of the freaking decade. Value add, everyone's value add. Well, how do we find those?
You touched on my favorite buzzword, but we'll touch.
Yeah, that is
we'll
a buzzword.
On, value add here in a bit. But a lot of people, if they're looking for mobile home parks, apartments, different categories of commercial real estate, you can usually go on a commercial website and filter it by asset class. You can't really do that with parking. So we have multiple sources. We work very closely with brokers, and we pay them very well. We work with operators, people who are operating the lots for owners on our, out there on the field. And then we pound the pavement, as I call it. We'll get out there to cities. We'll schedule trips around, I don't know, let's say Chicago, and we'll pound the pavement and walk the streets and come up with locations, phone it back into our office and have our administrators do title searches, tax searches, and try to get the names of the owners. We'll get on the phone with them while we're still there, and then we ask to have a conversation with them. And that's, it's a lot of work. It's not easy, but that is really how you find these opportunities. So as you walk around the cities or drive around the cities, you'll spot these parking lots. They'll stand out. And then those are the ones you truly try to go after. However, if you're an investor out there, do not get discouraged doing your due diligence, because you're never going to be able to get the records that will justify the investment. So you have to do an additional amount of work and be able to know what type of revenues you're going to generate off of this investment, not necessarily what they're presenting to you.
How do you do that? I mean, you sit there for a week and just have a little manual clicker in your hand and count how many cars come in and out? How else would you actually achieve that type of due diligence?
When we first started, unfortunately, we were naive enough to yes. You know, we would sit there in our car and we'd watch the amount of cars coming in and multiply by the rates they're charging, try to calculate any special events that there may be. At times, we'd get hotel rooms overlooking the parking lots whenever we could and just sit there and try to do our homework. So that got old really quick, and we just didn't have the resources for it. And somebody starting off is actually going to do that. That's really the best way to learn. If you're serious about becoming a parking investor, the amount of knowledge you're going to gain just by doing that is going to amaze you. But what you do now is you put to bid a lot that you're thinking about purchasing. So let's say you found a lot, you want to buy it, but you want to find out what the true value is. The easiest way to do that is to contact three operators in the area and just tell them, this is the location, I have an opportunity here, how much will you lease this property off of me for? So you're going to buy property A. You're going to pay, let's say, $1 million for the property. You do not want to operate that property. Unless you're an operator, and very few operators actually buy properties, you do not want to operate that property. What you want to do is hire a professional operator and have them give you a guaranteed lease for 5 years. You don't want to do anything longer. You don't want to do anything shorter. So you ask them for a guaranteed payment, and you put all three of them against each other. You will get a number that is very close from all three of them. Once you have that number, then you can put a value to the lot. So don't tie up the lot, you know, don't purchase it, don't put a hard deposit down until you have the number from the operators. Because then once you have that, you can actually tell what the lot is worth and what you're going to be willing to pay for it.
I'm assuming this is probably it's a very small entry. When you really get into the micro side of things, it's a small tight entry. Everyone, all the bigger operators, those that own more than one or two lots, probably know one another, right? And so, is there a concern if you're looking at a lot using the scenario you just gave us? Is there a concern where you're going to call around and talk to the other operators about potentially leasing this lot you have the opportunity to buy? Is there the concern that they might undercut you? I mean, they're going to know which lot you're talking about because you're going to have to tell them where it is, and they probably know who the owner is. And so, if you don't really have it tied up, should you be concerned about them undercutting you and going behind your back? And if so, how do we eliminate that risk?
Are you talking from experience?
I mean, I've had that happen before. I'm sure you have too. Right? I mean, it's a common risk. I mean, especially when you spend a lot of time and energy, you know, identifying an opportunity and getting as far as, maybe it's not under a contract yet, but you've got some time tied up into it and some emotions tied up into it. The last thing you want to do is have all that be wasted away by acting too soon or doing something foolish, to where someone could come in and, you know, undercut you, or, you know, and just, you know, pay higher price, whatever it might be, but just go behind your back. I mean, it happens all the time. We know it does. And that's why things like purchase contracts exist, and that's why broker agreements exist, and you know, to protect all of us. So,
correct. And what you want to do is you want to go with some of the national operators, such as Standard Parking, ABM, Denison. Those are some of the larger ones that come to mind, because they do not own parking assets and they cannot purchase parking assets. It's in their business model. So they're always hungry. They're always willing to get new locations. And I have not had any experiences where these type of operators are going to go around your back because they're unable to buy them.
Okay, that
and
makes sense.
So the people giving you...
So they're just third-party managers then. Okay.
Correct. The people giving you bids don't have the capital or the power or the energy that, or aren't sophisticated enough to really go and do that. I think where you have to be careful is if it's an owner-operator. So if you're asking an owner-operator who owns other sites but also operates, then you run a little bit of risk. But that's really the most foolproof way to conduct your due diligence when you're new, especially, and you're trying to purchase a parking asset.
Okay, that makes sense. I misunderstood then. I didn't realize that those three people you were referring to were not owner-operators. So they're just strictly third-party management companies that just manage these assets, but they don't own anything in their portfolio. Okay, so that makes sense then. Fair enough.
And the overwhelming majority of operators are simply operators. And the reason that is because they don't have the capital. And it requires capital to purchase these parking assets. So most of them stick to a quick startup that doesn't require a lot of capital, and that's operations.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the financing side of things then, because obviously you said it's really difficult to evaluate some of these, you know, what we would classify as value add opportunities, those that are not automated yet. They're, you know, they don't really carry, well, I guess if they're being managed by a third party larger management company, then they've got good solid books, right? Or let me back up a little bit before we talk about financing. So this brings up another question. If a lot, let's say it's owned by a mom and pop, it's owned by a single operator, but they have a larger outfit that's managing it for them. Let's say, but prior to that third-party management company coming in and managing that parking lot for them, do they require that they automate it, or will they actually just take it over with the existing process in place, whether it's got a physical pay toll operator or whatever working there, or it's got one of those little slot boxes that you were talking about? Do they require that they actually go in and automate the payment process before they'll take it over?
No, they don't. And most of the time, there's some operators that will try to automate, but they have to get the owner to pay for it. And most of the times, the owners don't want to pay for it.
Gotcha.
I'll give you an example as to the value in automation. In the 50s and 60s, at one point, there were over a million gas station attendants. They used to pump people's gas in their vehicles. Today, if you exclude Oregon and New Jersey, which require actual humans to pump gas, there's about 98% of those jobs that have been eliminated.
Mm-hmm.
In the parking industry, we're going through a similar phase right now where, by some estimates, there's anywhere between 500,000 and 1 million people actually still working in the parking industry, and you're seeing that number come down. So as the industry goes through this dramatic change in automation, you're seeing the amounts of people decrease as well. But we're going through such an interesting time right now where a lot of the human labor is being replaced, and you have things like pay and display machines. You've got license plate recognition systems where it eliminates a lot of the machinery. You have pay by cell phone. So you're seeing this dramatic shift in the industry, and it's really presenting great opportunities for people out there that are looking for the right opportunity.
Okay. So how will a bank, on the financing side of things, how will a bank or a lending institution, how will they actually do the evaluation? Will they just do the exact same underwriting that you suggested we do, you know, contact three operators? And this is assuming that the parking lot really doesn't have any good financial books or records. Will they do the same thing to come up with their evaluation of what they'll actually lend on?
if you want to have your property financed, whether it's your garage or a parking lot, the easiest way to do it is to go to an operator, one of the majors that I just mentioned, and say, I want a guaranteed 5-year or 10-year lease.
Okay.
So once you get that in place and you get a commitment letter from the operator, you can take that to your bank. And as long as you have at least 35% down, you'll be able to get it financed.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
so
makes sense.
So banks are starting to come around. Yeah, banks are starting to come around. They, for the longest time, they didn't view parking as a real asset class. It was always kind of a mystery, one of those cash businesses, I guess similar to coin-operated laundromats at one time that were just not very desirable to finance. But now they've come around, and they're starting to see the value in parking. And if you have a guaranteed tenant in place, then it makes it a lot easier to finance, usually with just, you know, about 35% down. And you have to remember, the real value in parking, I know we're talking about the ins and outs of the actual ways that the parking lots or garages operate, but the real value in parking is really in what we call the air rights, if you're familiar with that.
Okay. So, you know, higher, better use might be a 20-story building or something like that. Is that what you're referring to?
That is correct.
Okay.
So you want to hold for development. That is how you're going to make a lot of money in parking. You can make a decent return of anywhere between 4 to 6% in steady, reliable cash flows. But if you want to become wealthy in parking, you have to hold for air rights. And the value is really in the future development of the land.
Okay, so it's just a long-term land grab strategy that has some existing cash flow coming in. So it's not like just buying a piece of raw, undeveloped dirt to where there's really no cash flow because you can't lease it out. It doesn't have a purpose until someone develops it. Whereas with a parking lot, it's got existing cash flow in place. It can support itself until the time comes when developer comes your way and wants to, you know, build whatever type of structure on top of your parking lot. At that point in time, you can either decide to exit or continue for a longer-term play on it. So that makes sense. I like that. That's a very interesting strategy. Talk to me about some of the average returns. I know it's all over the board, so it's kind of a loaded question. But give me kind of like an industry average when we start talking about, like, you know, urban located parking lots. I mean, is it 4%? Is it 5%? 8%? What's the average returns in this space?
We'll talk about any market you want to, except New York City. So just throw Manhattan out the door and don't even mention it. So let's talk about the Midwest. So you can find parking assets in the Midwest right now between 5 and 6.5%.
Okay.
Okay. And these are good secondary markets, such as your Cincinnati's, your Indianapolis's, good solid markets that have the potential to become the next tier one city, but right now are, you know, what we call tier two cities. Everybody's looking for the next Nashville, the next Austin.
Mm-hmm.
7-8 years ago, you could have bought anything you wanted in downtown Austin. You really could have.
Yeah, I know.
And today, if you can even find a 1% rate of return on a surface lot in downtown Austin, I'm a buyer. In San Francisco, Seattle, you have negative cap rates on parking. So what that means is that your property taxes are higher than the net income you're going to generate on that investment. So if I told you I had a great deal for you right now, Kevin, at a minus 1% cap rate in San Francisco, well, let's say I came to you 3 years ago, what would you have said?
I mean, I that's not my type of investment, so I would have said absolutely not. But I get where you're going with the story.
Well, most people are going to say, they're going to say, no, you're crazy. But San Francisco has been growing, or it grew historically at about 12% rate of return on these surface parking lots per year.
Mm-hmm.
So would you rather have a 4%, 5% in a Midwest city, or a minus 1% that eventually is growing at 12%? So
sure.
There's a lot of, I use this point to illustrate one thing, is that it's the value of the land is appreciating at a far greater rate than what you're getting on your annual return.
No, I get
so
it.
What you want to do is you want to find good properties in downtown locations or near demand generators where you're going to get a steady return on the parking asset, but you're going to hold out and really make your money through development.
Mm-hmm. So in the scenario you gave with like San Francisco, so really there's got to be a forecast of like an exit. I mean, you have a little bit more of a plan in place with something that you're not going to hold it necessarily for 20 or 25 years, because obviously it's a little bit more of a cyclical market. And so, I mean, if you'd have bought it 3 years ago, that 12% that you're talking about, I mean, that's appreciation, and it's not realized until you exit out of that property. And so in that scenario, I mean, it's, you're really rolling the dice a little bit, right? I mean, we know that at some point San Francisco is probably due for a correction. I would have to say so. I mean, can it continue to grow at 12% a year? I'm not sure. You know, who knows? But it's a little heated right now. And is that a concern that you would have if you were that buyer 3 years ago? What would your long-term game be? I mean, would it be to get in, gain 4 years worth of appreciation at that 12% and then try to exit out, you know, as soon as possible? Or would you really try to push it to the brink and see how long you could go before things slow down?
If you were lucky enough or just brilliant enough to acquire land that just appreciated that rapidly throughout the years, have an exit strategy.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough.
Because everything is cyclical. And even in parking, what you're seeing right now is, we'll take, let's say, your Seattle's, your San Francisco's, LA's, where developers are purchasing these surface lots at such a rate where the returns are nothing or negative.
Mm-hmm.
And what will happen is that one day, who's ever still holding the land and the market turns, they're going to lose the property.
Mm-hmm.
And what will happen is the bank will take over the property and they'll put it back to the market, and somebody within the parking industry will purchase that and it will revert back to a traditional parking asset with traditional parking returns.
Right.
The market will get heated again. They'll sell at development rates and the cycle repeats itself. So if you find yourself in a position where you were lucky, fortunate, brilliant, you have to have an exit strategy. Now, if you're focused on great markets, like the Midwest, your tier two cities where you're earning 5-6%, you can afford to hang on to those properties and ride out cycles.
Sure.
So there's a difference. So are you building for a reliable cash flow, such as the REIT that we're representing right now, long-term strategy in place, or did you just get lucky? If you got mm-hmm. lucky, get out.
Right. Okay. Fair enough. Fair enough. How about, you know, in the mobile home park space, I mean, we have some ideal minimums in terms of size or number of units to achieve some basic economies of scale. I mean, doesn't sound like that necessarily exists in the parking lot space, because as you had mentioned, a lot of things that you're really looking for are really the air rights. I mean, so as long as there's some underlying cash flow and it can support the debt, the debt service in place and all the other expenses that would come along with it, and the air rights have a value to them, then really it doesn't necessarily need to be a certain size lot then, right? I mean, if the higher and better use is higher and better and there's more value in it at some point in time and the underlying parking lot pays for itself and it cash flows, then it could be 10 spaces or it could be 1,000 spaces. Am I correct with that assumption, or are there some ideal minimum sizes to achieve with, you know, to get that economies of scale?
No, you are correct on that. You certainly want to achieve scale if you have the capital, if you're a large institutional investor. What will happen is you're going to be able to negotiate the best rates from an operator. They're going to have lower insurance costs, lower labor costs all across the board if you have scale. However, if you're starting off with a single asset and it's a small asset and you can make a cash flow, you're fine. You're okay. You don't necessarily need scale like you do in other industries.
Okay. What's the average transaction size you guys are seeing? I mean, you guys are a broker in the side of the business. I mean, is it a million to 2 million, a million to five, 10 to 15? I mean, what's the average transaction size that you guys typically deal with your clients?
I would say the minimum type of investment that we see that you can make work and cash flow is between the $4 to $5 million range.
Okay.
Anything less than that, it's going to be a situation where it's not generating enough cash flow. There was a major tenant across the street that moved out, a hospital that closed down, where the return just isn't there, and it's going to require a lot of work for you to make it cash flow. I would say $4 to $5 million is a pretty sweet spot where you can find locations that you can make work and be profitable and will actually have some type future development value. If you're buying properties under $1 million, it's highly unlikely that you're going to have much of a future development play unless you hold it for a very, very long time. On the high end, typical garage, we're seeing anywhere between $15 to $25 million for a good garage in a good downtown location. And it can go higher than that, but not, it's not typical.
Okay. Sounds good. Okay. I mean, the scenario you gave originally, you know, we first started talking, like your first deal you did, that one, you know, there at the stadium where you tore down a couple old houses. I mean, I guess those examples, I mean, those situations still might exist. I mean, for some of the smaller time investors, right? I mean, where they might be able to assemble a few lots together, do a tear down, and have some kind of piece together parking lot like that. I mean, is that still an opportunity for the small time guy, or are they few and far between?
There are opportunities, but it requires work, persistence, and you have to build a network. Brokers are a great source, but what I would suggest is look for opportunities that may have a parking component to it, but may not necessarily be advertised as a parking component. And I'll give you an example. We were hired by the REIT that we represent to look at a property in downtown Milwaukee. And they were advertising as a Thai restaurant in downtown Milwaukee for $2 million. Well, most people, if I told them I've got a great deal for you at a Thai restaurant for $2 million downtown Milwaukee, they're going to say, you know, you're crazy. But we looked deeper into that, and we found out that they owned a 50-space surface parking lot adjacent to their restaurant. And it was also where the new Bucks Arena is being built.
Ah.
So what we did is we told them, look, you keep your restaurant. We have no interest in that, but I will buy your parking lots for $1 million. The parking was generating $50,000 a year. It had all the typical signs, a booth with an attendant there, and their model was just wrong. They were parking monthly parkers there at a rate of $50 a month. And monthly parking is a form of discount parking, which you don't want. You want transient parking that turns. So you want turns all throughout the day on the same space. So we closed on the transaction at a 5 cap. That doesn't sound very exciting. But we fired the attendants. We got rid of the booth. We replaced it with an automation station. And we signed a lease with an operator for $160,000.
So that's beautiful.
Same property, somebody could have purchased that for $1 million, and it could have flipped it for about $3 million within a few months.
Wow.
We had another deal next to the Methodist Hospital in Memphis. You know, most people aren't going to want to invest in Memphis, but it's next to a hospital. We know that's a great demand generator for parking. It was being offered by a bank for 1.2, and this is a property my partner and I actually personally bought. We negotiated it down to $462,000. And the parking component of it is making about $100,000 a year.
Wow.
Shut down the building. We have no interest in being landlords. We know nothing about medical tenants. So we have a 50,000 square foot building that's sitting vacant, but we're making about $100,000 a year from parking at this small parking lot next to a hospital in Memphis.
That's very impressive, especially when you add leverage into the equation.
Absolutely. And
wow.
There's opportunities out there, but you just have to know what you're looking for. You have to be educated in the parking industry and getting out there, pounding the pavement, making calls, talking to operators is really the best way to do it. You could go to trade shows. The National Parking Association, which we're members of, have annual trade shows. You walk the floors, you meet people, and you just have to start gaining knowledge. If you have the time, if not, you're going to have to hire an expert, tell them what you want, and they'll go and find assets for you.
Okay. Talk to me about the automation real quick. So what does that process look like? I'm assuming the company that you would buy the automation station from, they're basically a merchant. I mean, merchant provider, and they're going to charge a transaction fee. And I'm assuming that they'll actually maintain that unit. I mean, that you literally just get money wired into your account each month, and they'll maintain the unit and take care of it and any upkeep that it needs. Is that a right assumption?
Correct. And I'll give you an example of our hospital lot in Memphis. We fired the attendant, got rid of the booth, got rid of the pit in their honor box pay station, and we put our own automated pay station. Now, the mistake that we made there is that we continue to accept cash at this pay station. Mm. But usually at a pay station, you can set it up to take coins, take credit cards, take cash, and then we added a component to be able to pay by cell phone. So we had to hire a person that goes and collects cash every week, and they deposit into an account. We're changing that model to go to strictly credit card. So we're going away from a cash system at all. Once that happens, then we basically have an operator that is there on a call, and we'll go and change paper for the machine. And you can even set it up so it doesn't even give a receipt, and then you have really nothing unless it breaks down. You'll call a service provider, go out there and fix it. You'll pay a monthly credit card fee and internet-based fee, maybe anywhere between $50 to $200 a month, depending on your level of transactions.
Okay.
And the actual machine will cost you anywhere from $15,000 to $20,000.
Gotcha. And there's really no fear of theft at that point, even though you're accepting cash in that machine, because it's accounted for. Right. I mean,
everything's accounted for. Everything gets directly deposited into your bank account. It's as easy as it gets.
Okay. John, what else haven't I asked you that's important, vitally important for our listeners to know regarding parking lot investments? Again, assuming that those that are listening in have never even explored, this asset class before.
I would say if you want to get serious in parking, there's a couple ways you can do it. You can actually invest in two publicly traded operators, which are Standard Parking and ABM, but they don't own any real estate.
Mm-hmm.
We are in the process of representing a REIT that it has filed to become a publicly traded company. So in the future, that'll be an option for people to invest in if they want to invest in the actual ownership of parking and have a diversified investment available. If you want to invest in individual assets, you have to have the capital or have a line of credit or have debt available for you to do it. And it is possible. It's just going to require a little bit of work. And what I would say is that parking in this country is really cheap compared to other countries. So we may be entering into what I call a parking hyperinflation period, where you're going to see rates in this country really increase dramatically. If I was to ask you, Kevin, what the most expensive parking city for a reserved monthly parking space in the country, I'm sorry, in the world, what would you say?
In the world? I don't know. Is it London?
In the world.
I don't know.
You're correct.
Is it?
London.
Okay.
London's around $1,200 to $1,300 per month.
I would have said London or London or Dubai, one of the two.
It's London. You're absolutely right about that. The top parking city in the U.S. is New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about $540. So you have $1,200 to $1,300 in London versus $540 in the U.S. That barely cracks the top 10. And only Boston and San Francisco even cracked the top 25 in the world. So parking in this country is very cheap compared to the rest of the world. And I think that's going to change. So you're going to be entering a period where you're going to be seeing a lot more of expensive parking. And if you're serious, this is as good a time as any to learn about the business and to get into it, because not many people really think of parking as an asset class.
Hmm. Interesting. Okay. So the first step for those that are listening in to kind of take the next step and to learn a little bit more, I'm assuming, not to hawk your book here, but, and I didn't have the chance to read it, but I'm assuming it's probably chock full of a great amount of content in there regarding how to get started in this business. So how can our listeners get a copy of that book? Can they get it off your website? Do you have it on Amazon?
Yes, you can get it off the website. And it's really an introductory basic guide to get started, just to introduce people to the parking space. But for those that are interested in a bigger type of investment, there's several resources. There's operators. There's people like us that you can contact. And then there's the National Parking Association, which offers books on investing and magazines that you can use to help you along your journey. And it's really one of those asset classes where a lot of people don't really want to share a lot of information with you, because mm-hmm. it's kind of that hidden secret of an asset class where, you know, they just don't want a lot of people chasing these assets, because quite frankly, there's not a lot of assets that really exchange hands. So yeah, you have a lot of people chasing few assets, and that's what makes it makes them even more valuable.
It sounds like probably very similar to what like self storage or mobile home parks were 15 or 20 years ago. You know, it's very fragmented, not many big players in the marketplace. People are, you know, there wasn't a lot of readily available information about how to invest or how to develop one. And but now there's lots of big players in the market, and they're trying to consolidate the industries, and they're doing a good job at it. So, but it's come a long way in the last 15 or 20 years. And it sounds like that's kind of where the parking lot space is at this point in time. I mean, like you mentioned, 65% of parking lots that are out there are owned by single operators or single owners, I guess is what you said. And that's a huge number. That's pretty staggering when you think about it. And you said there's, what, about 40,000 individual parking lots in the U.S.? Was that the number that you gave us?
That is correct. And,
okay.
And those are estimates based yeah. on the best available data that National Parking Association can put together. And really, those numbers may be a lot larger.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good deal. Well, John, now we're getting to the part of the show where I like to ask, it's like a favorite question of mine. I ask it to all the guests that are on the show, and I'm going to ask you to jump into your DeLorean, go back in time, go back into year one when you're just getting started in this business. So basically back to when you're, you know, attending Notre Dame for your graduate degree, and before you bought that, or actually maybe while you were buying that, you know, those dilapidated homes and creating that parking lot for the stadium. Knowing what you know today, if you can go back then in that point in time and give yourself some advice, what would that advice be?
I would say stay stupid. and I mean that, because if you look at everything we've done, it was people looking at it saying, that's stupid. You know, take your life savings and your partner's life savings and buy dilapidated old homes next to, you know, a stadium in South Bend, Indiana. That's stupid. What you're going to sell your land off for student development? Stupid. You're going to start a brokerage company for just parking assets, and you're never going to take any other listing, which we have never done, by the way. We've never taken any other listing besides parking listings. And they'd say that's stupid. So I would just say really stay naive and really believe in what you're going to do and what your vision is, and that you're going to be able to do something great. And believe it or not, sometimes that happens.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's great advice, because, you know, typically when you look back and you really showcase those that we look at that have achieved major success in their lives, you know, whether they're big names or just unknowns, either way, but if you look at kind of the path that they've taken, more than likely they've probably gone against the grain of what, you know, their immediate peers or their coworkers or whoever they surrounded themselves around, you know, probably told them, or probably what kind of advice they received from those individuals. They probably went completely the opposite direction, right? I mean, you got to do the opposite of what the masses are doing. I mean, if someone's telling you no, don't do it. I mean, it might be valid advice. I mean, so if someone that's your senior that's been in the industry and you're just getting started and you're about to invest $10 million into a property, and you've got 10 guys your senior that are telling you no, don't do it, and you really don't know too much, you haven't done your due diligence, and you still think it's a great idea, well, then you might lose. But if you've done your due diligence, you've done your homework, you got a lot of people, you know, that are naysayers in your life telling you that it's stupid, and really they haven't done anything big in their lives, then you're probably actually making the right decision.
is
my take on it, right? I mean, just go against the grain, and sometimes you're going to win, sometimes you're going to lose, but if you're not losing, then you're not making any progress, right? I mean, if you haven't failed yet, then you just haven't tried hard enough. I mean, I fail every day, I think. Well, good deal. Well, John, this has been a lot of fun. Before we go here, before I share your website with our listeners, I'm going to enter into what I like to call the golden nugget segment of the show. And this is where we kind of round things out. And what I'd like you to do is, if you could leave our audience with one last golden nugget of advice or wisdom that may inspire and help them as they progress in their real estate investing career, what would that one last golden nugget be?
Sure. I actually have it for two situations. You know, if you're in a situation where you're looking for a moment of clarity, whether it's to make an important decision in your life or to get yourself up, maybe you're down or trying to create a great opportunity, I ask listeners to take my 40-hour fasting challenge. And I guess I have to put a disclaimer, if you're unhealthy, you know, please don't try it. I'm going to sound like one of those drug commercials, but if you're able to, take a 40-hour fasting challenge. For me, typically it's 40 to 45 hours where you don't eat, you don't drink if you're able to, and just really gain clarity. Turn your cell phone off, turn the TV off. It's okay to read. And during that time period, it's a struggle. It's a personal struggle. It's a mental struggle. It's a physical struggle. But by the time you get to the end of those 40 hours, you simply sit down, you meditate, and you just open up to whatever challenge is ahead of you. And you will be amazed at what you're able to achieve once you're able to do that.
Interesting.
And you're welcome to call me. My cell phone is on our website. My email, you'll be able to get hold of me. But that is really a very unique way to take on a challenge and to really, really approach it when you're at a crossroads in life. And I've been high, I've been low, I've been everywhere in between, and I've always found that this has always been a great exercise for me to help me through these times. Hmm. If you're doing great, you're looking for a new perspective in your business, whatever it may be, read about different subjects. I would just say if you're focused on business, read about a lot of other different subjects. Mm-hmm. I have great books that I could recommend. The Fish That Swallowed the Whale, which talks about the consolidation of the banana industry. You have The Match King, Ivar Kruger, who tried to consolidate the match industry in the early 1900s. And by the way, most of the SEC laws that we have today are because of Mr. Ivar Kruger. Hmm. Currently, I'm reading about Axl Rose from Guns N' Roses, and it just gives you a different perspective on life, on business, on your employees, and it allows you to really tackle challenges from a different perspective.
No, that's great advice. So, I'm really into health and fitness, John. So that's, but I've never gone through a fast like that. And I've done like juice cleanses, where it's just green juice. We just juice kale and spinach and other types of greens and just survive on that for, as long as, I think we've done 5 days, it's about as long as I've gone on something like that, but I've never actually fasted before. And so just to clarify for those that might have an interest in attempting something like this, so no liquids either. I mean, no water or anything, just a complete fast.
Well, what I do is I'll take sips of water throughout the day, small okay. sips. And that's entirely up to you though. So if I'm doing it for the first time, I would drink water and okay. then gradually wean off of it. But the internal challenge that you're going to face is going to blow you away. And if you really want to become advanced, around your 40th hour, start walking through restaurants, even at the 25th hour. Just walk through a restaurant, walk through a fast food place, and see people. And you'll see people at their biggest weakness, which is that they're dependent upon food and drink. And you can step back and say, I'm not one of them. I can challenge and I can tackle problems greater than what these people are able to. I'm better. And the perspective it gives you, it will blow you away. It's nothing that I can even do justice to talking.
Sure.
But if you've done it, or once you attempt it and you achieve that moment of clarity, contact me and we'll talk.
Okay. You have kids, don't you, John? You have kids?
I have.
Okay.
Three kids, two girls and a young boy. And
I'm just wondering how that, when you do this fast, how you handle family life as well, because I'm sure it gets a little, I'm sure you're very edgy and you can get easily aggravated, 25 hours into not eating or drinking. So I'm wondering how you survive around, your family and kids and not really fly off the handle and just stay, peaceful and calm. I mean, is that part of the challenge? I'm assuming, right?
The challenge is to not let anybody know that you're actually doing.
Okay. Even more of a challenge. So okay.
If you're able to do it without anybody knowing that you're doing it, that just speaks to what you're trying to achieve.
Okay. I love it. Well, fantastic advice, John. Well, this has been a lot of fun. I mean, very, very insightful information. I know I've learned a ton. Like I told you before we started this call, I knew nothing about this industry. I mean, I obviously read up a little bit on yourself, but I purposely didn't read too much into it. I didn't Google a lot of terms about investing in parking lots. I didn't try to research too much because I wanted my questions to be authentic because I didn't know too much about it. And I really wanted to take it from the perspective of what I feel a lot of our listeners are viewing it from, as they've never looked at this asset as a potential investment. So I've learned a lot today. You shared some great information and I really appreciate your time. And for those that want to learn more about John and his company, they can go visit him at jnlparking.com. Again, that's J nlparking.com. And John, that's all we have for today, my friend. I appreciate your time, and you take care and you have a great week.
Kevin, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Congratulations! Now you've got more of the best tricks of the trade in building massive amounts of passive income from real estate. For more amazing resources, visit realestateinvestingforcashflow.com, and we'll see you next Monday morning.